content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll begin with an article titled The Ravine by Joshua Hammer. Plans to create a uniquely ambitious Holocaust memorial at the site of an infamous massacre were finally underway. Then a new war in Ukraine changed everything. In a forested park on the western edge of Kyiv, Ukraine, near the ravine known as Babyn Yar, Ole Shovenko leads me to a 20-foot-tall steel frame that looms over a weed-choked field. This half-finished art installation is called the Kurgan, a word for a type of prehistoric burial mound found in Russia, Ukraine and Russia. When it's completed, Shovenko tells me visitors will enter the roughly 260-foot-long tumulus through one of two portals. Then they will descend 10 feet into an artificial canyon illuminated by a skylight. Here a series of miniature dioramas built to scale and making use of plasma screens and virtual reality displays will bring to life an unfathomable horror, the murder of 330,771 men, women, and children. A huge portion of Kyiv's remaining Jewish population at the ravine on September 29th and 30th, 1941. The atrocity, carried out by an SS Einsatzgruppen mobile killing unit, Nazi police, and several dozen Ukrainian collaborators, was by many accounts the single deadliest mass killing of Jews during the Holocaust. As many as 70,000 more people, including other Jews, Soviet POWs, and Roma civilians, are believed to have been murdered in the ravine in the 2 years that followed. Remarkably, until now, the massacre of Kyiv's Jews has never been properly memorialized. To recreate the ravine as it looked 80 years ago, artists, architects, and historians studied geological and aerial surveys carried out before the war by Tsarist and then Soviet authorities, plus all available historical maps, some dating to the 19th century. The images showed the original network of ravines as well as five cemeteries, including a Jewish one, which existed on the site before the Nazi invasion. The research and design team also had access to snapshots taken by a Nazi photographer immediately after the massacre. The plan for the Kurgan, which is constantly evolving, now calls for using 3D printers to fabricate thousands of 2-inch-tall, individualized figurines of victims and their Nazi executioners to recreate scenes from the massacre and its aftermath. Visitors will observe the gathering of Jews on the outskirts of Kyiv, their march to the execution ground, the mass shootings in the ravine, and the Nazis' desperate attempt 2 years later to cover up their crimes as the Red Army advanced toward Kyiv. Finishing this is our priority, Shovenko tells me. It's important to put a roof on it so that people can spend some time here and get to know the story from beginning to end. Shovenko is the deputy artistic director of the Babyn Yar Holocaust Memorial Center, a $100 million complex years in the making that aims to combine meticulous research and artistic innovation to create the most grand-scale World War II memorial in the world. Originally, the center was conceived as a single large museum, but beginning in 2020, those plans evolved into a vastly more ambitious project, including many art installations, plus at least four separate museums. One, the Museum of Victims of Babyn Yar, would recreate Ukraine's vanished Jewish culture using photographs and the commonplace stuff of life, furniture, candelabra, vintage radios, and other memorabilia gathered by the staff. Another, the Museum of Oblivion, would document both the efforts by the Soviet Union to whitewash the massacre after World War II and Jewish acts of resistance against Soviet denialism. Footpaths across the 370-acre former killing ground would link the facilities. In October 2021, around the 80th anniversary of the massacre, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was joined by Israel's President Isaac Herzog and Germany's President Frank-Walter Steinmeier to dedicate the partially built complex. The Ukrainian government expected that the site would soon take its place alongside other revered Holocaust memorials, Poland's Auschwitz-Birkenau Memorial and Museum, the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam, Berlin's Memorial to the Murdered Jews of Europe, as a hallowed place for remembrance and contemplation. And as a symbol of the belated recognition of the atrocity, it was also regarded as a means of helping to cement Ukraine's progressive new role in Europe. Then, on February 22, 2022, Russia invaded Ukraine. Troops occupied Kyiv's suburbs and besieged the capital. A Russian missile strike near a TV tower adjacent to Babyn Yar killed 5 people, including 4 members of a family. Staff members fled the country or went off to fight at the front. Shevchenko laid mines along the Belarus border unit until, he told me, an episode of PTSD compelled him to leave the army. Meanwhile, 2 of the memorial center's main funders, the Ukrainian-born Russian-Jewish billionaires Mikhail Friedman and German Kahn, who had close relationships with Russian President Vladimir Putin's office circle, were sanctioned by Western countries, obliging them to withdraw their support. The center's staff shrank to a skeleton crew, and the many ambitious projects came to a halt. Today, the Kurgan, instead of being the memorial's flagship installation, stands half-finished as a symbol of a violent disruption. I lost my inner motivation after the war began, Shevchenko admitted. Now, nearly 2 years into the conflict, the Babyn Yar Center, an organization dedicated to a distant atrocity, is reconceiving its mission and finding new relevance in the process. It has realized that it can't ignore the atrocities being committed today, and that staff members can even put their skills as researchers and museum professionals to use. The work now is smaller scale and lower budget, but if the center's ambitions have changed, they have not exactly diminished. They reflect a desire not only to properly commemorate, at long last, the historical injustice perpetrated here, but also to acknowledge and record the crimes and the suffering of this new war. In addition to preserving records of centuries of Jewish life and identifying the massacre's victims, many of whom remain anonymous, the center's staff members are compiling details about Ukrainian civilians killed in Russian airstrikes and artillery bombardments. Others have interviewed victims of Russian atrocities as part of ongoing war crimes investigation. This is our current reality, says Anna Furman, the center's deputy CEO. No one is immune from the risks and threats of death while in Ukraine. I visited Babyn Yar in early June during a short lull in Russian attacks on Kyiv. Almost every night for 4 weeks, Russia had launched Iranian drones and hypersonic missiles at the capital. Patriot missiles provided by the United States destroyed most of the incoming fire, but falling debris killed several people, including a mother and daughter who failed to reach a shelter in time. All through May, sirens and explosions jolted residents out of bed before dawn and sent them scurrying underground. When we met, Shevchenko had barely had an uninterrupted sleep in weeks. Shevchenko led me along a tree-lined path through a public park, past cyclists and couples on benches, to see how far the project had progressed before the Russians attacked. In a clearing near the Kurgan, an operator flicked a switch and an electric motor whirred into action. Slowly, a huge wooden pop-up book opened to transform itself into a walk-in model of Ukraine's historic wooden synagogues, complete with Hebrew prayers on the walls and a ceiling exquisitely painted with the constellations, that appeared on the first night of the killings. Ukraine's small Jewish community and many visitors prayed here regularly before the Russian invasion. But most of the Jews and the rabbis have left, and it's not very much in use, Shevchenko said. I crossed a pathway to confront the somber stillness of the Crystal Wall of Crying, an installation by the internationally celebrated Serbian performance and conceptual artist Marina Abramović. It consists of a lengthy wall of black anthracite embedded with long pink quartz crystals, which represent healing power, and is meant to evoke Jerusalem's Wailing Wall, the only surviving remnant of the city's ancient Jewish temple complex. Nearby stood the Mirror Field, a stainless steel platform with 10 reflecting steel pillars pocked by bullet holes. The bullet holes had been made in 2020, before the outbreak of the current war, when Ukrainian special forces fired thousands of bullets, amounting to 2 tons of metal, into the steel, almost the exact amount of ammunition used to murder Kyiv's Jews. Shevchenko and I walked silently among the columns, meant to symbolize the broken tree of life. A pipe organ and audio player underneath the platform filled the air with the haunting music of Ukraine's vanished Shtetl culture, archival recordings of Yiddish songs of the 1920s and 30s, and voices reading the names of some 18,000 Jewish victims. The number of Jews killed at Babin Yar, who had been positively identified when the installation was completed 3 years ago. The figure is now up to 29,220. Not far away, in the middle of the footpath through the park, we came across a monument to an unrelated tragedy. A 160-gallon glass tank filled with mud and resting atop a column of bricks stamped with logos of Kyiv's brick factories. The installation, conceived by Shevchenko himself, serves as a reminder of the multi-layered horrors that played out on this site during World War II and afterward. In November 1943, after the Red Army recaptured Kyiv, Soviet authorities began to fill in the ravine with liquid waste from nearby brick plants. On the morning of March 13, 1961, after heavy rains, 1 trillion gallons of slurry broke through a dam and inundated the city's Kurenivka district. The deluge is thought to have killed more than 1,500 people. Soviet authorities, evading responsibility, never confirmed more than 145 fatalities. Filling in Babin Yar had a larger purpose than disposing of excess sludge. It was part of a systematic effort by Soviet authorities to erase all traces of the massacre, a cover-up that has given the Holocaust Memorial Project even greater historical resonance. Driven in part by the anti-Semitism of Joseph Stalin and other communist leaders, and in part by a resistance to singling out Jewish suffering at the hands of the Nazis, the Soviets built high-rise apartment buildings and a television tower on the site, turned some of it into a park, allowed much to revert to wilderness, and arrested those who sought to pray here or otherwise memorialize the victims. They said, "Come on, we lost 27 million people. Is that nothing because we were not Jews?" says Patrick Desbois, a noted French war crimes investigator and a Catholic priest whose 2008 book, The Holocaust by Bullets, documented the murder by gunfire of 1.5 million Jews in Eastern Europe during the first phase of Hitler's so-called final solution. As late as the 2000s, Desbois and his team faced obstruction from Russian authorities while researching the killings. Still, the site was hallowed. In 1961, 20 years after the massacre, the Soviet writer Yevgeny Yevtushenko published his poem, Babi Yar, the Russian language name of the site, in the prestigious Russian periodical, Liturnaryana Gazeta. The opening line, "There are no monuments over Babi Yar," poignantly evoked not only the atrocity, but also the policy of silence enforced by the Soviet regime. Natan Sharansky, the Soviet dissident turned Israeli politician, was a 13-year-old boy in Stalino, now Donetsk, when he heard Yevtushenko's elegy. I remember how my father, with a trembling voice, was reading it from Literaturnaya Gazeta, saying, "Finally, we can speak about it," Sharansky told me recently. Days later, they started attacks in the press on Yevtushenko, but the poem doesn't disappear. 5 years later, the Soviet monthly literary magazine Yunost published a heavily edited version of Babi Yar, a document in the form of a novel by Anatoly Kuznetsov, who had been a 12-year-old boy in Kyiv at the time of the Nazi occupation. In 1969, Kuznetsov defected to the United Kingdom, carrying the unexpurgated version of his harrowing story, based in part on documents and eyewitness testimony he'd gathered in the decades after the massacre. The book was published in the West the following year. In 1975, on the anniversary of the killings, Sharansky and a dozen other Soviet Jewish activists boarded a train to Kyiv and to visit Baba Yar. The KGB arrested them before they reached the city and detained them for 2 days. Baba Yar is not only the biggest grave of the Holocaust, says Sharansky, who is now chairman of the Memorial Center's supervisory board. It's also the biggest symbol of this effort of the Soviet Union to erase it from memory. After concerted pressure from international and Soviet Jewish groups, the Soviets agreed in the 1970s to place a small memorial at the site, but it referred only to Soviet victims. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, Ukraine's leadership lifted the veil of secrecy and denial. In 2016, President Petro Poroshenko, the billionaire owner of a confectionery company, gathered commitments to fund the project from Friedman Khan and the Ukrainian-born Jewish oligarchs Viktor Pinchuk and Pavel Fuchs. But in 2014, Russia had illegally annexed Crimea and started the war in the Donbas, and many Ukrainians bitterly opposed any Russian participation. Some believed that Friedman and Khan planned the project as a Trojan horse to somehow push a pro-Putin agenda. But Sharansky says that Friedman, who lost several family members at Baba Yar, never made any attempt to disseminate Russian propaganda. Besides donating millions of dollars to the project, Friedman also recommended that the supervisory board bring on Ilya Karzanovsky, an enterprising, avant-garde, and sometimes controversial Russian-Jewish filmmaker, to design the memorial. Friedman had visited the production offices of Dow, Krasnovsky's ambitious series of films about the Stalin-era physicist Lev Landau. To shoot the films, the director had constructed a vast mock-up of a fictional Soviet research center in Kharkiv, Ukraine, and populated it, Truman Show-like, with thousands of extras who lived there around the clock for years. Dow reflected the kind of grand-scale cinematic vision that Friedman and the board hoped would re-energize the Baba Yar project. "He mobilized a huge field of people," Sharansky told me. "He brought in dozens of talented young Ukrainians, specialists in history and art." I met Krasnovsky on a summer evening at a cafe in the Wilmersdorf neighborhood of Western Berlin, where he lives for much of the year. He has Russian, Israeli, and German citizenship. A baby-faced 47-year-old, wearing a black trench coat and black pants, he had taken a break from the editing room, where he was finishing work on a new film. When he arrived in Kyiv in 2019, he told me, lighting a cigarette, the board envisioned a single large museum on the site of the killings. Karzanovsky, whose mother fled central Ukraine on the last train ahead of the Nazi onslaught in July 1941, tossed out the plan. "If you're a child and have no connection to the Holocaust, how can we make you want to come?" he said. "I felt we needed to build something interactive, different installations where people can feel something about evil, about the fragility of life, and can understand what a Jew was, what kind of world disappeared." Alexei Makukin, the center's chief executive, told me that Karzanovsky's arrival marked the moment that this idea of a single museum was replaced with a new concept, taking over a whole territory. Karzanovsky poured forth hit-or-miss ideas that delighted some observers and infuriated others. His first idea was to dig a 300-foot-deep scar at the exact site of the killings, build a museum at the bottom, and place the soil in a huge glass container. The project was abandoned because it would have meant excavating part of an old Jewish cemetery. Another proposal aimed to use video-recorded testimonies of Holocaust survivors, gathered by Steven Spielberg's Shoah Foundation, to generate holograms of people from the past who would share their stories with visitors. Yet another potential project, only briefly discussed, would have taken advantage of deep fake technology to transport a visitor into the execution scene at the ravine and plant the viewer's face onto a Jew about to be executed. Critics accused Karzanovsky of seeking to turn the site into a Holocaust Disneyland. The attacks against him widened, focusing on his Russian background and an unfounded accusation that he had violated child labor laws on the set of Dow. Charges against him were later dropped. Karzanovsky endured the attacks on his leadership. He attended the opening of Mirror Field in 2020. Soon afterward, he broke ground on the Kurgan, named after the Tumuli, the Bronze Age nomads, on the Caspian steppe erected over graves and filled with chariots, weapons, and other possessions meant to accompany the soul in the afterlife. Months later, Putin began massing troops at the border. Karzanovsky was at his parents' home in Israel when he received a call that Russia had invaded Ukraine. In Kyiv, Makukin, a former media consultant for the Ukrainian Defense Ministry, helped organize an evacuation from the capital in nearby towns. Dozens of staffers, a handful of nonagenarian survivors of the Babyn Yar massacre, and the descendants of righteous people who had hidden Jews during the Nazi occupation, piled into cars and headed safely into the Carpathian Mountains. Makukin and his colleagues had reserved most of a hotel at a ski resort, where many evacuees remained for weeks. Karzanovsky has not returned to Kyiv since the invasion, and in September 2023, he publicly announced his resignation from the project. His Russian identity, he had told me back in June, had made it impossible for him to continue. "When I was growing up, there was no difference between the Germans and the Nazis," he said. "And it's logical it's this way with Russia now. It doesn't matter what I did for Ukraine or what I want to do. They don't want it and they don't need it." One afternoon, I went with Irina Irchek, a Babyn Yar Center researcher, to the State Archive of Kyiv, a hulking brick tower built in 1972, where the center is in the midst of an ambitious digitization project to preserve millions of historical documents. The trove dates back to the late 17th century and contains important records pertaining to the 1941 Nazi occupation and killings, including, for example, the original posters in Russian, Ukrainian, and German that appeared days after the Wehrmacht occupied Kyiv on September 19, 1941. The placards ordered Jews to gather their documents, money, and valuables, also warm clothing and linen, and assemble at 8 a.m. on September 29th at the corner of Melnikova and Dokhterivskaya streets. Anyone who failed to appear, the poster warned, will be shot. Desbois, the French author and war crimes investigator, said that most who gathered that morning believed they were going to be deported or sent to labor camps. "The Germans were forbidden to kick Jews," he told me. "The Jews had to think that they were just moving somewhere else." Reality didn't sink in until moments before the execution, when they were stripped naked and marched to the edge of the ravine before being shot with Mauser semi-automatic weapons. Bodies fell on top of bodies. To save bullets, children were sometimes pushed into the pile alive to be smothered and crushed. Desbois himself turned up lurid details about the murders in German archives, including an account of a food vendor who had accompanied the executioners and provided them with sandwiches and drinks during the killings. He had to walk with his small van around the naked people who had come to be shot, Desbois tell me. He had to set up tables and make tea, and each team was shooting, stopping, and going to eat. Desbois also studied rare color slides taken by a Nazi photographer who captured the massacre's immediate aftermath. When Soviet POWs were ordered to collapse the walls on the ravine on top of the bodies. The images show arrangements of the belongings Jews left behind. The artificial leg of one victim with a coat and a hat, a woman's boots beside a canteen, and a small family photograph. When I arrived at the archive in Kyiv, employees were examining the interrogation protocols, or interview transcripts of 18 Soviet prisoners who had escaped from a Nazi concentration camp in 1943. That summer, the Red Army had launched a massive offensive, rolling back German lines along the Eastern Front as it advanced toward the Dnipro River in Kyiv. With the Soviets moving swiftly across Ukraine, the Nazis rushed to destroy all evidence of their crimes. Soviet prisoners were among 321 captives whom the Nazis ordered to reopen the mass graves and cremate the corpses of Jewish victims just before the Wehrmacht's withdrawal. Prisoners who didn't escape were shot upon finishing their gruesome work. And we will stop there in that article. We will finish this article on our next program. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.